the internet, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, wherever you go now, people are social networking. But what is happening with our privacy? What's happening with the internet? And what is government trying to do? In a moment, Lauren Weinstein joins us. We'll talk about all these issues on Coast to Coast AM. Lauren Weinstein, of course, been involved with the development of the internet for decades, beginning his involvement in the early 70s, way back then, as the first site of the internet's ancestor, which was part of the Defense Department. Lauren is also an expert regarding a wide range of privacy issues. Here he is back at Coast to Coast. Hey, Lauren, how are you?
Fine. How you doing, George?
Good to have you back with us. Gosh, you were working on the internet before there was even a computer, almost.
Before there was an internet, actually. when it was the DOD ARPANET that gradually morphed into the internet, actually, from an effective standpoint.
But Did you see the commercial applications at that time?
At that point, in the earliest days, it was not obvious that the work we were doing specifically would ever see the light of day outside of the limited universe we were working in. I personally had assumed that the phone companies would do it a completely different way, where they would charge you for every bit, every kilopacket. There were some early work that was already being done in that direction. It didn't seem likely that the kind of technology that we have now, with the possibilities for open interconnection and the kinds of freedom-enhancing things that we have now, would be possible. The irony is, of course, that after all these years, we see the telephone companies, the ISPs, the cable companies trying to regain control, and we see the government massively trying to crack down. So my hope is that we haven't just lived through a golden age, which is about to become the dark ages.
Well, you may be right. What's new now? What's going on with this bipartisan attempt to regulate and control the internet? As we know, by the way, you know, the head of internet security, the commander, was saying that he is opposed to the United Nations taking control. But what about here?
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about the United Nations taking control, because the U.S. is not going to let the internet out of its hands, except probably at the point of a gun. And unfortunately, it's looking more and more like the kind of internet the U.S. government wants is starting to look something like, you know how in China, they have the Great Firewall of China, how they control
That's right.
the internet in China? Well, it's starting to look like the Great Firewall of America.
Uh-huh.
We've talked in the past about the Protect IP Act in the Senate, and excuse me, all the horrible things that would do.
Sure.
And now it's starting to look. You remember the film Nightmare on Elm Street?
Oh, I sure do.
Right. You all these horrible things would happen, and you'd wake up and you'd go, "Oh boy, that's over. It was just a dream." And then, of course, Freddy's hand would come reaching out of the mattress or something, and it turned out, you know, it was even worse. And that's basically what we have now. New legislation has been introduced in the House of Representatives. And this time, the guys in the back room who work out the really stupid acronyms have been, you know, really, really hard at it. This one's called E-Parasite. That's, you can't make stuff like this up, George.
No, you can't.
That's the Enforcing and Protecting American Rights Against Sites Intent on Theft and Exploitation Act. that's a thing of beauty, isn't it?
It is.
In a perverse kind of way.
Who came up with that one?
I don't know who did it, and I don't know. He's probably in a padded room somewhere now in a straitjacket at this point, or he should be. But this thing is just—it's such an abomination. It's sort of like all the we wants and we wish and might have been that law enforcement and the entertainment industry have wanted ever since Betamax days. You remember in the early days of when Betamax came out, when VCRs first came out?
Yes, it was Betamax versus VHS.
Even before that, when Beta itself came out, there was a big controversy. The entertainment industry was opposed to them being capable of recording television programs.
Right.
And that was a big deal back then, the copying of the, quote, illicit, unquote, copying of television programs by consumers. And that ultimately, there were court decisions on that, and it ultimately was found to be permitted. But they never really liked that. And now what we see is all these years later, that the kind of sick thinking that was trying to take VCRs away back then has come back, multiplied thousands of times, and is now being applied to the internet. Because what E-Parasite would do is basically allow the entertainment industry, in league with government, to, for all practical purposes, shut down any site that they want to. Without, this isn't saying that you have to have a court order. They could just basically say, we believe this site is infringing. We think this site's doing something wrong. We turn it off. Now, you can complain after you've been turned off and all of your visitors have been diverted to some page that claims you're a pirate, something like that. They'll never return. But this is sort of a situation where the concept of due process is just thrown out the window. The bill would eviscerate, destroy most of the safe harbors that are in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That's the legislation that's basically acted as a safe harbor for sites and for internet service providers so that they didn't feel like they could get sued. Otherwise, everybody along the line gets sued. This legislation has anti-circumvention language in it. In other words, if you try to come up with a way for someone to circumvent what's going on, that is criminalized in this. And of course, it applies to the entire world. This is the U.S. saying to the rest of the world that because we control so much of the domain name system, we are going to act as judge, jury, executioner for your websites too. And it's unlikely the rest of the world is going to be really happy with that. What are they going to do? They can break off. The internet can fragment. Basically, it's a disaster.
Yeah, indeed. Tonight, I saw 10 people running around with their smartphones at a restaurant, Lauren. You know, getting in and out of Facebook, Twittering people, checking the internet. Absolutely riveting, watching them maneuver and do what they do. A couple people had their iPads. This is not going to stop. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, I see people walking down the street, not looking, walking, texting each other. You know, one guy almost ran into a pole. I mean, it's amazing. Where do you see it going in the next 5 years?
Well, like you said, it can only grow. The question is, in which direction will it grow? There are basic problems inherent in the kinds of ways that we interact with these systems, in that we have to depend on the people running these systems to do it in a reasonable way. This is why you have so many people who get upset about various things that Facebook does, for example. You mentioned Facebook. Their privacy policies are generally considered to be somewhere south of McMurdo Station, you know, down at the South Pole.
That's right. almost non-existent.
Well, you know, it's not so much that they're non-existent. It's that they seem to be designed purposely to confuse. And they change the rules on a dime. And if you're smart enough to go digging all the way through their privacy settings and things, it's questionable whether you should really be using the site at all, because you're probably too smart to be even wasting your time that way, fighting your way through badly designed privacy settings.
Yeah.
So there are ways to design these things that are good. There's ways to design them that are bad. And then on top of that, you have the problem of government coming in and demanding information from these sites. So the more information we hand over to them, the more risk is, because they have to obey the law, right? I mean, if there's a law that says they have to hand something over, they do. Google just put out, and they're just about the only company like this that does this, they put out a report that explains how much information they've had to turn over to governments on requests. In different categories, different sorts of things that governments demanded from them. Sometimes that's information on users that the governments demanded, and they usually have to comply. That's the law. Sometimes it's takedowns, which, of course, is a whole other area now where governments and individuals want things taken off the internet, which, by the way, is something that the E-Parasite bill also addresses. It would also force sites like Google to remove links to sites that the E-Parasite bill says are forbidden. So it's actually search engine censorship also on top of everything else. In Europe, there's a push for something called the right to be forgotten. That's an interesting.
What is that?
The right to be forgotten is the concept that if there's something on the internet that talks about you that you don't like or that you disagree with, you should be able to get it at least in theory, removed from the internet. You should, as if it never existed. Now, of course, anyone who knows the internet knows that's really impossible because there's copies of things everywhere. Sites are mirrored.
Right, and they keep popping up. You can't get rid of them.
Right. So in reality, what this is, as far as I'm concerned, is a new way to keep lawyers fully employed. I mean, it's to file lawsuits because they go from site to site to site saying, well, here it is. It's like whack-a-mole, right, trying to do this. And of course, it has massive censorship potential also. Who's to decide what information is correct or incorrect or makes you look bad? So basically, from all these different angles, all this is coming together in ways that are probably making Freddy Krueger, pretty happy.
You know, Lauren, let's look at the demonstrations for a moment. And let's say, like the Arab Spring, people go online, they Twitter, they go on Facebook, and they round up everyone to come demonstrate. What's wrong? I'm going to be the devil's advocate for a moment. What's wrong with government being able to, one, shut down internet, shut down cell phones in order to avoid these demonstrations? Now, that's me being the devil's advocate.
Yeah,
obviously, I don't agree with that.
Now what's really interesting about that is that the United States, the federal government of the United States, the State Department has formally argued against the ability of other governments to do that. They have argued against censorship in other countries. They have argued against other governments shutting off internet access or cell phone access or things like that. In fact, the U.S. government has gone as far as working with people to develop little suitcase-sized boxes that could be taken into those areas that would sort of provide, the satellite links and things like that, to provide instant internet access, instant cell phone access, and such. It is ultimately bizarre that on one hand we say, well, in those countries governments shouldn't do that, but we turn around and in the U.S. try to create legislation that goes very much in the same direction and puts the power in the hands of the entertainment industry in many cases. It just seems wrong-headed. It seems bizarre. You have to understand that the e-parasite legislation and the Protect IP legislation on the Senate side, which is really the companion to it, these are very strongly bipartisan pieces of legislation. This is both parties. They're both complicit in this, which tells you where the money has been flowing, as far as I'm concerned. Because here we are, our economy's in shambles. Most of us don't have good health care. A lot of us have no health care. There's no jobs. Real estate's tanking. There's so much important for Congress to be doing. And they're fighting all the time. They can't even settle between themselves for the simplest things. And yet, when they should be trying to help us, they can get together. They can work in a bipartisan way to further enrich entities that are already rich and to impose censorship on the internet. To me, that's just very, very sad.
Where do you see this all headed, Lauren, down the line?
Well, there's several different ways it can go. One of my fears is that we are approaching kind of a chaotic state in some ways here because people are becoming desperate. And when people become desperate, you don't know what's going to happen. We see demonstrations going on now. We know those are being driven by fear and concern and desperation. And we've never had the combination of this kind of broad desperation and this kind of technology which allows people to communicate and organize and discuss these things. This is a time that hasn't occurred before where there's this kind of juxtaposition. And it's impossible to really predict which way that'll go. If our leaders, if Congress continues the way they're going now, it is very possible that people will act in ways that could be very damaging, and it's going to be very hard to blame them. I mean, I see people on the social networks that I read all the time, that I participate in, these are very intelligent people. These are people who are programmers and technologists and folks who've been designing these technologies and working on these things and people that use them. And they are just livid. They're livid and they're scared. And some of the things they say are very, very strong. And I think we could be headed for a major, major chaotic situation. And when you have chaos like that, there's no telling where you come out.
And people have gotten so used to this now, Lorne. The internet, its comfort factor. Honestly, when I prep this program, I would be lost without the internet these days. When I have computer problems, whether I'm in L.A. or St. Louis, it's a nightmare wanting to get them fixed, desperately wanting to get them fixed, so I could do what I have to do for Showtime and prep. I mean, you know, nowadays with everything happening, you need quick sources, and you have to have the internet to do that. And my God, we've come a long way, but go ahead.
And well, I'm just saying, more than that, and you're 100% right, and I think we're all in pretty much the same situation now. But what's even more important is that you have to know that the sources of information you're getting are free and open, and that you're not being censored, and that information that someone doesn't want you to see is being turned off the internet, taken off the internet, especially without due process. You start with saying, well, we're only going to do this for a site that's engaged, obviously engaged in piracy, and then it turns out to be a site that might be engaged in piracy. And as we've seen in the past, what tends to happen is when one site is taken down just due to the technology and combined with stupidity on the part of some of the people involved in these takedowns, sometimes thousands of sites, innocent sites, have been turned off at the same time, or even worse, diverted to pages that say this site was engaged in piracy or this site was engaged in child pornography, when these are innocent sites that were just collateral damage. Imagine what would happen if the Coast to Coast AM site, just by virtue of where its IP addresses happen to live, one day got diverted to a government warning page like that.
Oh, my gosh. I know. And that's conceivable. That could happen one day. We push ourselves as being truth seekers, Lorne. What happens when information that comes from programs like ours are muffled?
You know, and the other thing is, you know, some people say, well, you know, they trust the government to use these vast kinds of powers in an appropriate way. And my response to that is, well, okay, that's just for the sake of the argument. Let's say you trust the current government. Are you going to trust the next government?
That's right.
Or the government after that? Because these kinds of capabilities to control the internet, once they're embedded in the infrastructure, in the legal system, and in the technology of the internet, they're not available just for the current government to use and current leaders, but going into the future. So you have to somehow have faith that everybody moving forward is not going to abuse this kind of power. Otherwise, you don't want to give anyone that power to start with.
One day you will get that kind of person, and if he's got that kind of authority and power, you're in deep trouble. There's no doubt about it. Deep trouble indeed. Lorne, I want to talk about the BlackBerry in its problems when we come back in just a moment, and also talk with you about emailing and instant messaging and this craze that seems to be taking this planet by foot on all this. How about yourself? What's new with you?
Well, I try to keep busy. One of the interesting topics that I hadn't really expected to be absorbing a lot of my time recently has been controversies over anonymity on the internet. You're talking about the rise of these social networks and how people use them more and more for so many important things. But a very controversial aspect of all this now is, should you have to always be identified as who you really are, or should you be able to use a pseudonym? This has turned into a very, very contentious area.
We'll be back with more with Lorne Weinstein on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your phone calls next hour with Lorne Weinstein as we talk about the internet and internet-related issues. Hey, by the way, our book, Talking to the Dead, is available at all major bookstores, and there's a steep discount at Amazon.com right now. It's a hardback. It's a great book, Talking to the Dead. It's all about how people are trying to communicate with the other side. I wrote it with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Talking to the Dead. And we'll be back in a moment as we talk to the living on Coast to Coast AM. Lauren, I want to react a little bit. BlackBerry has been having some problems. They're being sued now in the U.S. and Canada by those who claim that they owe them money, breach of contract because of their breakdown over the Internet.
Yeah.
No emailing, no instant messaging, minimal net access. What's going on in this arena?
Well, I'm not a financial guy, so I don't tell people, you know, what they should do with stocks and right. their investments and things like that. But I'm very concerned that that Research in Motion, RIM, who is the company behind BlackBerry, is kind of reaching the end of their rope in a number of ways here, and this latest breakdown in their network, which was really quite extraordinary, is not the first sign that they have problems. And the way they've reacted to it, I believe they basically just said, well, they'd offer people, I think, a discount on some apps or some free apps, something like that, as if that was going to make it all better after basically having their whole global communications network go belly up for several days. On top of that, their technology really has started falling behind. And I'm not thinking so much about their network infrastructure, which is kind of unique in the way they funnel everything through their own servers. That's had certain benefits and certain downsides, as we see. But in the face of technologies like Android, like the iPhone, advanced smartphones of all sorts, the BlackBerries are starting to look like something out of the Flintstones.
Yeah. They're like the old flip phones of the old days.
Yeah, you remember when that was the latest thing, and how often do you see people with a flip phone now who aren't driving a 1928 Porter, basically.
That's right. So, I know a guy who still has a flip phone and the antenna pulls out.
Yeah, well, but see, he doesn't get a signal anymore because it's an analog-only phone, so he doesn't even, he's just talking to himself on it now.
That's right. Yeah. That is too. The old razors are going away. Why has Android come on like gangbusters?
There's several reasons. I mean, one of the benefits that Android has, obviously, is it has Google behind it, right?
So right.
That means immediately a great variety of services and things become available for it on day one and moving forward. The other reason is that because it's essentially an open platform, it is on a vast array of hardware. And if you think about the iPhone is a product. I mean, it is a specific device of various models as time goes by that are manufactured by Apple for Apple. And it's all part of the Apple ecosystem, which is generally viewed as a kind of closed ecosystem. On the other hand, Android is an operating system, so it can go on a lot of different things, not just on phones, but in TV devices and on tablets and in watches and all kinds of things now. So the sheer numbers that are involved when you have a wide array of hardware to put an operating system on, especially when the operating system is basically open sourced almost entirely. There's certain Google-specific programs that they don't release the source to, but the vast percentage of Android is open sourced, so people can hack on it. They can make their own versions. I have an Android phone here. I have a G2, an HTC G2, and I rooted that phone, which means I broke the protection on it very early on, so that I could do things to that phone that you can't do in a standard way. And I was able to put an operating system on that, a version of Android on that phone that's called CyanogenMod. And that gives me all kinds of power over that phone. It's completely legitimate to use. I burned the warranty in the process of doing that. But other than that, it's an amazing thing to have that level of control over your phone and the apps and things like that. You can't do that on systems that are more closed. You can jailbreak an iPhone, which is another term for rooting them.
Mm-hmm.
But after you've done that, you're not going to have the kind of control, because the iPhone operating system is not open sourced, so you're not going to find complete replacement systems of the quality of CyanogenMod. And there's lots of others too. So it really comes down to the old question for us old software guys of, you're looking at a closed environment or an open environment. And I think the reason Android does so well is it's very much an open environment.
Is it beating the Apple iPhone now?
You know, it depends on what metric you look at, you know, how you measure it. But I believe that at this stage of the game, the number of activations of Android phones every day are now in the lead. I think that it either it just passed over or recently passed over iPhone in terms of the number of activations. But you'd expect that because you have so many different phones that can run Android. It just is logical that you would be able to get ahead. And when you have it open to the degree it is, that's going to be to your benefit too. Now, there's people that don't want that kind of environment. There's a lot of people who feel more comfortable in the sort of protected environment of Apple, where the App Store, the apps are at least ostensibly screened. Of course, that can be very, very controversial. On the other hand, when you look at the Android market, basically it's not screened, and that bothers some people. But for people like me, I say, hey, that's the way I want it to be. I'll take responsibility for my phone and for the apps I put on it. So Android is really pulling ahead now, but that's not to say Apple's in trouble. They're not. The new iPhone is a very good phone. It has a very dedicated market segment, and it's not going away, that's for sure.
What's new technologically in the future? Is anything going to be beyond Android, beyond the iPhone?
Oh, I'm not falling into that trap. If I start trying to make predictions like that, I'm going to lose. But I think that there are certain things we can predict, assuming we have an internet that we're allowed to use, right? I mean that has.
So you think there are real possibilities that we won't have internet freedom that we have right now?
Oh yeah. I think that's not just a possibility. I think that's a high probability right now. Exactly in what way that those restrictions will come about, and to what extent they'll be permitted by courts and things like that in this country, a lot of this will end up in front of the Supreme Court, I'm sure, ultimately. That's harder to say, but I think it's very clear that there's a lot of, you know, there's a sort of a grand alliance between Congress and various entities who want to control the internet to control the internet and to push back against all these scruffy programmers and internet freedom people and those folks that are for civil rights, and, you know, old-fashioned stuff like that. So, yeah, I think that's going to happen. On the other hand, we may live in an environment where our internet gets closer and closer to the Chinese restricted model, but we'll probably have real nice high data speeds.
I this is what I see happening in the future, Lauren, probably sooner than later, and that would be like a governmental department of internet screeners who basically are website killers. These people would be responsible for getting information on websites. Let's say somebody sends some legitimate information and says, look, this is a porn site for minors. You know, this is illegal. And before governments even have a chance to arrest these people and try to convict them, the internet killers merely hit a button and their site's gone and you can't get into it.
Well, that's exactly what legislation like E-Parasite and Protect IP contemplate. Okay. That is the model they have in mind. That through some mechanism, for you know, maybe it's a major entertainment company. They hand over a list to the government and they say these are the sites we believe are infringing. It doesn't have to go to trial. There's no prosecutor and defense attorney, all that. They just turn those sites off at the domain name system or under E-Parasite in even worse ways. They're harder to
instantly.
Yeah, and they turn them off, and then you can theoretically come along and say, well, you're wrong. I'm innocent. You shouldn't have done this. And maybe they'll turn you back on if you can demonstrate that. But, of course, by then, the damage that's been done to you has been enormous.
Well, I mean, like Alex Jones and his websites, Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com. You know, he takes a lot of pot shots at government, legitimately so. But let's say government doesn't like what they read on Alex's website, and they just hit the button. Off he goes. They're controlling speech.
Yeah,
and that's dangerous.
That's the whole idea, right? I mean, it's wrapped up. If you, of course, the proponents of these kinds of legislations don't say that it's about controlling speech. They say it's about controlling piracy. So if you look at the organizations that are lined up in support of this, these are all the kinds of companies who have been concerned, you know, about Betamax, right? We're talking about Betamax in the early days, and about people using reel-to-reel tape recorders to record records in years after that. And then they were upset about cassette machines recording records and people trading cassettes, and then the internet. You know, it goes on and on and on. So these are the organizations that are doing this, and they've got it all oriented, the arguments are oriented toward piracy, because what they think is that, well, you know, who's going to be in favor of piracy, right?
That's right.
You're not. I'm not. No reasonable person is, right? But, of course, the way these laws are written, it's not going to stay that way. Not only do you have the problem of, like we were talking earlier, about the collateral damage that happens when one site that has been labeled a pirate, maybe it actually is a pirate. Maybe they are actually engaging in some kind of piracy, or maybe they're innocent. Either way, they turn off that site, and a lot of times a lot of other sites get damaged as well. But I think what bothers me the most about the whole mentality of this kind of legislation, even leaving aside the slippery slope that it leads to all kinds of other restrictions on speech beyond this, the supposed main focus of piracy, is this whole concept of skipping due process, of just throwing due process out the window and essentially saying, you're guilty, we're turning you off, you're out of luck, and then if you can prove later that we were wrong, okay, we'll turn you back on. Good luck. Yeah.
We're going to be God, and you aren't. Simple as that.
That's right. That's the view. And unfortunately, we have both parties that, frankly, have been so well funded by the entities that are pushing this kind of concept that Democrats and Republicans alike are on board on this. And, of course, the only people that are left out are all of us.
Well, these things could happen. They could happen. Now, do you think the Internet should be totally 100% free so the lowlifes that are playing around with it can actually do what they do, the haters, the pornographers, those that are doing what they do?
Well, I think you have to be careful how you categorize things, right? I mean, there's some things that we all think are terrible, like child pornography, right? Unfortunately, what you find is legislation that's written to control child pornography in particular tends to be written in a way where it can then be used for all kinds of other purposes. So it's like, no, you know, it's like child pornography or malware, you know, viruses and worms and things like that. Fighting them is something everyone's going to agree on. Talking about more traditional pornography, then you're getting into a much grayer area, because some parts of the world, if a woman exposes her bare foot, you might end up in jail. So that's much tougher. But things like child pornography and destructive viruses and things like that, we all agree are bad. But if the laws are written in such a way, and they inevitably are, that they can be applied to all kinds of things beyond that, beyond those certain things that we can agree are bad, then basically I think we've been suckered. And frankly, I think that kind of expansion of control is very much on the minds of many of the legislators and officials that push this kinds of legislation. I think they're being very hypocritical from the word go.
Lauren, some of the other problems, too. I mean, the entire world wants you to go paperless now. And so if you pay your bills online, they don't want to have to mail you a paper statement. And they simply say, you know, check this, and, you know, we'll send it to you via email and stuff like that. If the Internet ever goes down, beyond just our communication abilities with each other, people won't be able to pay their bills, because most of them are paying online and have stopped receiving paper invoices.
Well, if you want an example of how bad it is, I mean, very recently, I think within the last couple of weeks, B of A was having, Bank of America was having trouble with their
horrendous problems
with their website
for days.
And
for
it
days.
Went on for day after day after day, and people were just getting into a panic because they had bills to pay, they had to pay their mortgages, they had to get into their bank accounts, all kinds of things they needed to do, and they couldn't do it. And they just didn't, and there's no good backup for people that have become dependent on that. Now, you know, I'm not saying don't use online banking. It's tremendously convenient. But as you say, we do have to be cognizant of what happens when these things break down, and they are going to break down, and they do.
And they do. There's no question about that. And, you know, Bank America still hasn't given any reason why they went down for so long. I think they were hacked. It came up shortly after they said they were going to charge fees for using your debit card.
Remember? Yeah, they deny that's the case. I mean, traditionally, the way sites have long, you know, extended problems like that, probably, you know, 7 times out of 10, it's because they were doing a software upgrade and they screwed it up. You know, these systems are so complex. But yeah, they're not going to tell us the details on something like that. I don't think that kind of information is not going to see the light of day.
Lorne, how did you get involved in all this, even the work with the earlier part of the Defense Department? Were you always computer savvy?
I was certainly always, you know, I was a kid who was, you know, screwing around with the batteries and the electromagnets and the buzzers and the little telephone mic earpiece units and things like that. I think what pulled me into the internet is very early on. I had a friend from high school who was who went to Stanford, and he got involved with you know, some of the work they were doing up there that was leading in this direction, and that got me interested. And back then, it wasn't as, you know, there weren't really formal paths to get engaged in a lot of this because the technology was so new. So you just basically kind of, you know, asked who's doing what, and if it looked like you could do something useful, they handed you a bunch of manuals and said, "Here, you know, go at it." What's sort of interesting, though, is that I started off very much in an engineering vein. I mean, writing software, writing code, doing systems work, and all that kind of thing. And it was only gradually over the years that I got pulled into all these policy areas, the kinds of things we're talking about now, primarily because I got more and more concerned as the ARPANET went from an experiment into the internet, which became the infrastructure of global communications. I mean, that's really what it is. It's going to be all telephone, all video, pretty much, all audio, radio. I mean, ultimately, it's probably going to be 95% internet, if not more. And as I saw that evolving, I got more and more concerned about the policy aspects of that, initially a lot with privacy, and then spreading out from there into other areas. So it wasn't planned. I mean, it wasn't something that I had contemplated early on, just one step at a time.
Would you say it's one of the greatest tools of mankind ever?
Oh, I think arguably it is the greatest communication tool of all time. It stands on the shore. You know, it's said that no great invention stands alone completely. You stand on the shoulders of giants, and certainly the internet stands on the shoulders of many, you know, brilliant people, but it has done something that no technology that came before it ever imagined possible, which is to give individuals not only the power to communicate with virtually any other individual on the planet to a large degree, but to reach large numbers of people in a way that is frankly scary, you know, to some governments and to various media concerns, because that's the kind of power for individuals to reach mass audiences that previously had been restricted to them. And that kind of power in the hands of quote, ordinary people, unquote, is something that has not existed before and may perhaps be the most powerful and most important aspect of the internet overall.
All right, our guest is Lorne Weinstein. And when we come back after the top of the hour, we're going to take your phone calls with him as we talk about privacy issues, the internet control, and even some tech questions for you. I'm George Norrie, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.